Welcome to Archway's Western Civilization History Podcast. In our podcast, we look for the best of the West and discuss the stories, events, themes, and people that made the West different from the rest. In previous episodes, we've discussed several dangers that the West has faced. The dangers of internal strife and how that hindered pre-Renaissance Florence. The dangers of democracy leading to tyranny and how that weakened Athens. The dangers of a secret police force and how that handicapped the Roman emperors. The dangers of slavery and how that degraded and threatened Venice. And someday I hope to talk about other dangers like inflation or ICBMs. That is not this day, however, for today I will talk about one of the most fearsome dangers of all, a type of civilization that produced soldiers and people that the West had no response to for over 1,000 years when they acquired gunpowder. These civilizations were a threat so terrifying, they have been referred to as the Wrath of God, the awakening of Gog and Magog, the horsemen out of hell. The ancient Minoans, who first saw them, thought they were centaurs, stomping, braying, half-man, half-animal monsters. I'm talking about the great and terrifying horse archer civilizations that emerged from the steppes of Central Asia and the Great Plains of America. Particularly, I'd like to talk about some of the most influential horse archer civilizations, the Scythians, the Parthians, the Mongols, the Magyars, and the Comanche. For lack of time, I will discuss the last four of these civilizations in part two of this episode, which will come out later this month. Today, I'll give you the background to understanding these civilizations by explaining the origins of steppe nomads, the geography of the steppes, the history of horses, and the development of horse riders in warfare. Then we'll dive into the first great horse archer civilization, the Scythians. The horse archer civilizations are part of a much larger category of civilizations known as steppe nomads. Not all steppe nomads were great archers or even great riders, and as a result, they didn't have as many interactions with the West. But I'm getting ahead of myself. To start, the steppe refers to the 5,000 miles of grassland from Hungary in the west to Manchuria in the east. In spite of stretching one-fifth of the way around the earth, it is a relatively narrow, or belt. It is bordered by the inhospitably cold taiga to the north and the cold, waterless Gobi Desert in the south. The rolling plains are occasionally broken up by the Carpathian Mountains in the west, the Ural Mountains, and the Altai Mountains in the center. The Altai Mountains divide the steppe into the more abundant west steppe and the harsher east steppe. The east steppe ends at the greater Khingan Mountains. While all these mountain ranges do occasionally interrupt the flat, rolling ocean of grassland stretching as far as the eye can see, they're not significant enough to slow down the migrating grassland herds and humans. The capital S steppes refer to the plains of Central Eurasia that I just spoke of, but the lowercase s steppes refer to any dry, grassy plains that occur in temperate climates. Thus, the short grass prairies of North America's Great Plains, in the rain shadow of the Rocky Mountains, stretching from Saskatchewan in the north to West Texas in the south, are another great steppe ecosystem, where indigenous cultures like the Kiowa, Crow, Cheyenne, Sioux, the Dakota and Lakota, and the Comanche thrived as steppe nomad horse riding civilizations, just as their old world neighbors did as well. Steppes, as a whole, are generally unsuitable for intensive farming and unable to support a dense, sedentary human population. Particularly, this was the case in antiquity. Now, of course, with modern agriculture, the American steppes and Ukrainian steppes have been transformed into some of the world's most abundant breadbaskets. Anyway, as a result of their arid nature in the past, the peoples who inhabited these lands relied on grazing animals for food. Animals such as goats and sheep were herded in Eurasia and used for meat and dairy, while in the Great Plains, the mighty bison reigned supreme as the primary food source. The people in these lands needed to be mobile as seasons and climates changed, as rivers moved, as grazing lands were exhausted, or animals migrated. The plants of the steppes are almost exclusively grasses or small flowering shrubs. The Eurasian steppes used to be the exclusive home of the famous Kali tumbleweeds, but in 1870, these noxious weeds were unintentionally sown with flax seeds in South Dakota. Their rolling balls of dried-up seeds and plant matter have now become a ubiquitous and iconic part of the American plains as well. But they're not the only invasive species taken from the Eurasian steppes and hyper-adapted to the Great Plains. No, the equally ubiquitous and iconic horse of the Great Plains, the Mustang, was also an invasive species. And the great Indian horse-riding civilizations didn't get into equestrian activities until the 17th century, when thousands of Spanish horses escaped during an Apache raid of the Taos Pueblos. Already perfectly adapted to their new environment, this wild feral horse, called Mustang from the Spanish word mestango, meaning wild cattle, spread through the plains like crazy. By 1900, there were 2 million wild horses in America. Horses have many adaptations that make them not only ideal occupants of steppe biomes, but also ideal candidates for domestication, becoming special partners to us humans. 35 million years ago, horses had 4 toes, but over time, nature selected horses with a big, strong middle toe, adapted to run on dry, hard ground. Horses also grew taller, with longer and stronger legs, enabling them to sprint swiftly across vast distances to avoid predators. Horses gallop at speeds of 25 to 35 miles per hour, but even the wild Mustang has been clocked at speeds reaching 55 over a short distance. Horses' digestive systems were designed for grazing the great grass fields of the steppes. They can extract nutrients from grass, and their large cecum allows them to break down cellulose effectively. In spite of the inherent difficulty in digesting grass, horses are able to digest it continuously without needing to rest. Horses lock knees. This enables them to conserve energy while standing, allowing them to stand for more than 20 consecutive hours at a time. Their sleek coats are also very efficient. They help regulate their body temperature. In the harsh, bitterly cold winds of the Great Plains, they fluff up their fur to trap in warm air, and in the agonizing heat, sweat soaks their hide, keeping them cool. Horses are also social creatures and naturally submissive to a dominant leader. They usually travel in herds consisting of one stallion and around 8 females and their young. Usually, one female, or mare, takes on leadership of her herd as well. Thus, when the stallion stays to fight a danger, she will step up and take the lead of the other horses. This social structure provides safety to confront the dangerous predators of the steppes, like wolves, cougars, and bears. This social nature also made them easy candidates for domestication. Horses were first domesticated around Krasny Yar by the Botai culture in the steppes of Kazakhstan over 6,000 years ago. This was about 8,000 years after wolf domestication, for comparison. At first, horses were milked or slaughtered for food. In Russia, the Samara culture offered them as sacrifices. Horse dung was used as fuel for fires and fertilizer. Over time, horses started being attached to plows and chariots. The first bit, the part of the bridle that goes in the horse's mouth to direct it by a rider, has been traced back to the Botai culture in 3500 BC. But it appears the Botai were way ahead of the rest of the world in riding horses. Most of the world stuck to having them pulling stuff, using horse collars and improving harnesses to help them tow more weight. The first time horses were ever used in warfare was when they pulled chariots around 2000 BC. But after the Iron Age, that all changed. It was around 1200 BC when the chariot would fall obsolete to a type of warrior that the world would never be able to defeat for over a millennia, the horse archer. Horse archers are a type of light cavalry. Light cavalry is meant to be fast and maneuverable. It is used for raids, skirmishes, and reconnaissance. While heavy cavalry is meant to be a sledgehammer of shock troops that break through a line, light cavalry is usually lightly armored, if not unarmored altogether. They carry small weapons, while heavy cavalry has heavily armored men and horses using short-range weapons like swords, spears, and maces. Light cavalry horses are usually smaller and shorter. It helps a lot when their riders are small and short too. Horses like the Arabian and Akhalteke fit this bill, weighing in at less than 1,000 pounds and under 15 hands, which is less than 5 feet. The first horse archers appear in Assyrian carvings in the 7th century BC, after conquering and scattering Israel. This type of horse archery involved 2 riders, one who would control both horses while their partner would shoot an arrow. Later, Horse archers were able to let go of the reins and shoot an arrow with both hands. This required unbelievable balance, a relationship with the horse, but most important of all, great technology. And that brings us to today's sponsor, Scythian Composite Recurve Bows. At the crossroads of history, you'll find an ancient craftsman like no other. His wizened hands place a bow in yours. It is short, it is light, and yet it is powerful. As you touch the glossy sinew and horn, you can hear it resonate in your soul. As you pluck the string, you hear a whoosh. That is the sound of the Scythian composite recurve bow choosing you, for it is a weapon that bridges both time and space. Crafted from a symphony of horn, wood, sinew, and ancient glue, the Scythian bow is a marvel. It is laminated construction. It channels raw energy, propelling arrows with lethal precision. When you draw this bow, you harness the very essence of the steppes. The Scythian bow's distinctive recurve shape maximizes acceleration and long-range accuracy. As you release that arrow, feel the power surge, a force that echoes across centuries. The Scythians, masters of the steppe, they perfected this bow. It was their descendants, the Parthians, the Mongols, and the Turks, who followed their example. Now it is your turn to follow. Unleash the power that once brought empires to their knees. Thanks, Scythian composite recurve bows. Anyway, that does remind me, the composite bow originated around 2000 BC among the steppe nomads, probably the Scythians. It is made from horn, wood, and sinew laminated together. These materials are much stronger than an all-wood bow. As a result, even with the same draw length, composite bows can be much shorter and deliver a similar amount of energy. Firing a long bow would be awkward and unwieldy from horseback. Composite bows are recurve bows, which means their limbs curve away from the archer when unstrung, giving a greater amount of energy and speed to the weapon, making even ancient recurve bows comparable to carbon fiber composites of today, and once again allowing them to be smaller while still delivering lethal force. Weirdly enough, the first reference to the recurve bow in history was written in the 8th century BC in Psalm 78:57. Homer also spoke of these bows in the Odyssey when none of Penelope's suitors could rebend it. Creating a bow like this required a tremendous amount of skill and craftsmanship, not to mention strength. You could easily break your arm messing with a recurve bow if you didn't know what you were doing. The Romans often bought these bows from the steppe nomads for their own archers, called the Sagittarii. The Romans also just straight up hired steppe nomads as auxiliaries, who served as Roman horse archers, called the Equites Sagittarii. Another important technology of the horse archer is the saddle. Saddles were first used by the Assyrians. They were cloths and pads strapped to a horse with a strap around the girth and breast called circingle. Early on, saddles became a status symbol, decorated with elaborate sewing and leatherwork, horns, wood, and other ornamentation. Saddles were further developed by the Scythians, who gave it a frame with leather cushions, a pommel, and a cantle. These saddles provided comfort and protection to the rider, raising him above the horse's back, as well as comfort to the horse, evenly distributing the rider's weight instead of having it all fall on one part of the spine. The saddle framework also provided a place for the next major development to be attached to. The stirrup was invented by the ancient ancestor of the Mongolians somewhere near China in the 2nd century BC. Stirrups gave stability to a rider, making them less likely to fall off while riding, and allowing them to use the weight and momentum of a horse in the stroke of their weapons. Stirrups also allowed riders to stand while mounted. Last year, when I described the Huns, who were early adopters of the stirrup, I stated, quote, "Standing in their stirrups, a Hun could fire forward, to the sides, and to the rear. Their arrows could strike a man 80 yards away and seldom missed their mark. In addition to this tactic, they would also use their herding skills to lasso their enemies on the battlefield, brutally tearing them off their horses and dragging them to a violent death. In some respects, the Huns were like proto-cowboys," close quote. As you can see here, stirrups were perhaps the most important innovation of warfare. Indeed, until the invention of gunpowder, nothing revolutionized it as much as these. Now that we have some background on the steppes, the steppe nomads, horses, and horse archers, I'd like to dive into those first horse archers, the Scythians. The Scythians were a nomadic people of Iranian origin from the 9th century BC. They migrated westward from Central Asia to regions in southern Russia and Ukraine around the Black Sea during the 8th and 7th centuries BC. Their women were depicted as having fair hair and blue eyes, while the men were short and stocky with red or dark hair. Frozen corpses show that the Scythians were heavily tattooed, with images of fantastic animals locked in combat all across their arms and chest. Their most significant achievements were the establishment of a powerful empire centered around Crimea. It stretched from West Persia through Syria and Judea to the borders of Egypt. The empire thrived for several centuries before eventually succumbing to the Sarmatians, another nomadic bunch of horse archers, between the 4th century BC and the 2nd century AD. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. They didn't shed a tear when they defeated the Sumerians, another nomadic horse archer civilization to the west of them. The Scythians played a significant role in cultural exchange along the Silk Road. Contacts with metropolitan China led to the introduction of gold from Central Asia, and Chinese jade carvers began imitating Scythian-style animal art, adopting designs from the steppes. The Scythian Empire was home to vast deposits of precious metals and minerals, and they became expert craftsmen. Their mobility and interactions with neighboring cultures facilitated the spread of ideas, language, and culture across the ancient world, laying the foundations for later Persian, Indian, and Chinese empires. The Scythians developed a complex culture, including a class of wealthy aristocrats known as the Royal Scythes. These chieftains left behind elaborate graves filled with richly worked gold artifacts and turquoise jewelry, and other valuable objects like horses, composite recurve bows, and saddles. The dead were buried in burial mounds called kurgans. These can be found across the steppe region. Much of what we know of Scythian horse culture comes from these mounds. From them we learn, as I said earlier, that the Scythians invented the elevated saddle frame that we use today, saving both horse and rider from thousands of dollars in chiropractor visits. And it is fitting. The Scythians truly loved their horses. Their horses were well cared for and often lived 15 to 20 years before being buried. Almost all horses were killed humanely in the same manner, a battle axe to the mid-forehead, the battle axe being the Scythians' weapon of choice when they weren't mounted. Horses were buried with elaborate costumes and hats. Some horses' hats depicted an entire bird or a goat roosting on the horse's head. Others had decorative antlers mounted on them. Horses were buried in their saddles, which were decorated with etchings of battles won, fond memories, and dangling pendants. Scythian horse equipment otherwise was extremely gentle on the horses and was extremely functional, durable, and light. As I said earlier, the Scythians also invented the composite recurve bow. With both bow and saddle, they were the first fearsome horse archers. As the British Museum explains, quote, Herodotus wrote, "None who attacks them can escape, and none can catch them if they desire not to be found." Assyrian inscriptions from the 7th century BC also refer to fighting Scythians, with one mentioning a peace treaty secured by marrying off an Assyrian princess to a Scythian king. In battles, the Scythians would use large numbers of highly mobile archers who could shower hundreds of deadly arrows within a few minutes. A Roman writer described the deadly effect of mounted archers like this, saying, "They do not let up until all have been completely destroyed." If this were not terrifying enough, several classical writers state that the Scythians dipped their arrows in deadly poison. Close quote. The last thing I'll say about the Scythians is that, like their horses, these legendary Scythian archers also wore very fun hats. They had distinctive pointy hats to go along with their wide trousers. And I think that pretty much tells you all you need to know about these Scythian horse archers. Now I'll let you get psyched to learn about the next four horse archer civilizations, coming to you later this month in part two. And that concludes our episode for today. Thank you, listeners, so much for listening and supporting our podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review and share with a friend. I'm Doug Archway, and that's history for you.